Thanks, Jesse and worship team. Well, we are in our third week of our series, What is a Real Christian? And in our first week, we talked about the decision that we need to make in order to follow Christ, and really how we come about that decision and maybe even the ramifications of that decision. And then last week, we talked about the need of a person to be transformed after making that decision. That there's a process, the $10,000 seminary word is sanctification, but it's the process of change that takes place in the life of a person who follows Christ, to become more like Christ every day, to be more like him today than we were yesterday, to be more like him tomorrow than we are today. And so this process of transformation takes place in a follower of Christ. But today, I want to talk to you about something that, something that Jesus identified was an important thing for us to know and mimic when it comes to our faith in him and our love for God. But before we get into our text today, I want to start off with a question. If you had the opportunity to ask God one question, okay? Maybe Jesus is in the flesh in front of you. What question might you ask him? You only get one. You know, you might waste it, at least I would think it's wasting it, on some kind of a philosophical, theological question, like, can God make a rock so big he can't lift it? Or how many, angels can dance on the head of a pin? I've heard these, and people have debated them and talked about them. Maybe you would ask a question about your own life, maybe an event that took place in your life. Maybe you would ask God a question about the world at large, or maybe something about salvation. If you had only one question that you could ask Jesus if he was standing right in front of you, what might it be? Well, there was a man that got that opportunity. And the question he asked, coupled with the question and Jesus' answer, put those two together, and you have a question that changed the trajectory of Christianity, that changed the direction of how we think about it and how we understand our relationship with God and his desires of us. And it fits perfectly in line with our series of what is a real Christian. You can find this question and answer in the 22nd chapter of Matthew. Before we get into our text, though, I want to give you a little bit of background of this question and how it came about. Jesus is pretty far along in his earthly ministry at this point. We know that Jesus lived somewhere around 33 years old. Prior to age 30, he was pretty much a carpenter, and though had some influence, we're not exactly sure what that was, but his ministry is really a three-year ministry. He's in his third year of ministry at this point. And he is taking a lot of heat from the religious authorities of his day, the Jewish leaders. There were two kinds of groups. There were the Pharisees and the Sadducees, two different groups. And to really simplify what these two groups are, the Pharisees are in charge of the religious life of the people, making sure that you keep all 613 of the laws of God in the Old Testament. So they want to make sure that you keep those. And then the Sadducees are more involved with the legal side, the governmental side of Judaism. It wasn't just a synagogue, it was a church that you went to, but the Jewish life encompassed your religious life and governmental life all together. And these groups argued with one another, and they had factions within that argued with one another, and I think that's just part of being human, as we divide and argue over anything that we believe in. They were no different. But they would come to Jesus, and they were pretty irritated at him because he was tearing down the religious system of the day. He would confront the Pharisees and the Sadducees, or just call them religious leaders. He confronted the religious leaders of the day, and they were irritated. They were looking for a way to trap Jesus in hopes that they could convict him. And if they could convict Jesus of blasphemy, they could even call for his execution. They were that upset with him. Jesus had a special pet name for the religious leaders of the day. Anyone know what it was? You got it. Brood of Vipers. Real nice name. And you might hear that and say, well, that doesn't seem like the nicest word to use. In Jesus' day, those were fighting words, all right? To call someone a brood of vipers is to say, your group, you religious leaders, you are looking, you have venom in you, you're poisonous, you're looking to attack and strike others, you're not to be trusted, there's evil in you. And so when he would say this, I mean, they would just be livid with him because he continued to break down their religious structure and continue to point people to God. But the religious leaders, they had some things pretty messed up in their understanding of their of what their relationship with God should be. Jesus, of course, was trying to set that straight. But the religious leaders were not happy about it. The people who were following Judaism started to follow Christ, started to follow Jesus. And so this tension started to build. So what these religious leaders would do is they would go to Jesus, and you'll see throughout the Gospels, they would ask Jesus questions. And sometimes you need a little bit of historical background to understand the meaning behind a question, but the question was posed to catch Jesus in a kind of catch-22. In other words, there's times where they would ask him about the giving of money. And so if he talked bad against Rome, then he'd be in trouble there. And if he didn't kind of tear down Rome and build up the Jewish system, then the people would be mad there. And so they'd try to catch him. Jesus always had this masterful way of answering their questions that would really reveal or throw back on them the condition of their hearts. And they were livid. In chapter 22 at the beginning, the Pharisees come to Jesus and question him, and he turns it back on them again. Then a little farther along in chapter 22, the Sadducees come to Jesus, and they're questioning about resurrection. They're trying to catch him again. Jesus again turns it back on them. Now we're at the end of chapter 22, and the Pharisees have regathered. They've brought a larger number, and they have identified what I might say is their top theologian, the one that's the quickest and the brightest, and they've brought him before Jesus to ask Jesus this question. And so that's kind of where we start off. So let's open up to Matthew chapter 22, and we're going to start at verse 34. But when the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees with his reply, they met together to question him again. One of them, an expert in religious law, tried to trap him with this question. Teacher, which is the most important commandment in the law of Moses? Now, when you hear that question, which is the most important commandment in the law of Moses, do you automatically know how in the world that could possibly trap Jesus? It just isn't obvious. What you have to do is you have to do a little bit of reading and understand what these groups were talking about and kind of what some of their focus was and why this question would be asked. In the Old Testament, there were 613 laws of God that the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the religious leaders were trying to keep. Knowing that it was nearly impossible, in fact, it was impossible to keep these laws, they devised a system. And they kind of broke the laws into two categories. They took 248 of them and made them important. And then they took 365 of them and made them less than important. Now, the Greek words for these are a little bit tricky, but that's basically what they boil down to. The ones that we pay attention to and the ones that, you know, maybe we do them, maybe we don't. Now, if you know anything about God's law, when God would give you a law, let's say he gives you two laws to obey. How many do you think you should obey? I'm going to say two, okay? If God gives us two laws and we say, well, we like one, but the other one we don't really like, do you think God is interested in our thoughts on that? Do you think that's going to really make a determination for him where he'd say, well, you know what, they just don't like that second law, so he's going to get rid of that one? No, it's his law, and he asks us to obey it. Now, in the Old Testament, there were 613 of them. Impossible to keep. And if you break one law, you're guilty of breaking all the laws. In fact, it says as much in the book of James, chapter 2, verse 10. It says, for the person who keeps all the laws except one is as guilty as the person who has broken all of God's laws. So you see, they had to keep every law and not just one. Now, God knows this, and so he created the sacrificial system in which if you broke the law, one of the 613, you could atone for that sin through the death of an animal. And that animal would be brought to the altar. Your sin, your breaking of the law would be placed on that animal. That animal would be slaughtered, and you would be forgiven until you broke the law again, which happened often, happened daily. So sacrifices were happening all the time. But the Pharisees and Sadducees, knowing it was so difficult, they decided to kind of start to categorize these laws. These are important, and these were just not so important. Does that make any sense to you? I mean, if you break one, it's as if you break them all. So why put these categories together? Well, they were trying to ease the blow and kind of ease the burden of the law. But as we'd find out as we read the New Testament, that the whole purpose of the law was to reveal our need for a sacrifice and our need for Christ. So the law wasn't there to save us. The law was to reveal our need for salvation. And so that's the whole point of the thing. And so when you break it, that's the reason why. So they're trying to trick Jesus into identifying with one of these 613 laws as the most important. And if they could do that, there was a huge debate happening in Judaism in which they were trying to identify which was the most important. Because if you could identify the most important, that's the one you would work on keeping. And then the others would just fall in less and less importance until you get to the bottom one, which apparently you don't even pay attention to. But everybody was all over the map on this thing. And there were lots of people following Jesus, and so the religious leaders said, if we can get Jesus to pick one of these, we're going to alienate him from an entire group. It's much like, I think, what you see in our political system today. In my lifetime, I've never seen the level of polarization that we have in politics today, whether it's conservative or liberal or Republican or Democrat or Wall Street occupier and Tea Partier. It couldn't be more different. And when the candidates are doing their debates, it seems like the questions are pointed at them to try and get them to hone in on one little area to alienate a whole larger group so that, you know, they'd lose those supporters. Very similar in Jesus' day. And so these guys, this religious leader, the wise one, the scribe, he comes and he asks Jesus this question. Hey, Jesus, which is the most important commandment? And it would have been a hush over the crowd. Oh, he did not ask that question. What in the world is Jesus going to say? And their ears are kind of tickling. You know, as I thought of their system of which ones do we keep and which ones are less important, and I look at that and I say, it's so ridiculous. I mean, obviously all 613 were important. You couldn't put one over another. But they were doing it. And as I pondered this week and as I thought about it, I realized, you know what? If we are brutally honest with ourselves, we do the same thing, don't we? I mean, we all have certain sins that we identify in the world and we say those are really bad ones, right? Well, that's an apostasy. Oh, those are horrible. Anyone who does that should be put to death. It's unforgivable what this person did. You see, in God's book, every sin, no matter how great or how small, has equal value. But we like to prioritize them. So we pick one thing that's terrible and we champion that, but then we kind of give ourselves a pass when it comes to, you know, gossip, white lies, lust. Lots of things get too out of control. You know, little things here and there. I mean, I'm a forgiving person, but not that person. Unforgiveness. And we categorize it. We put them in some category in our head like, well, you know, God's all good with me, but like these things, he kind of gives me a pass. But they're just not as important. I mean, at least I'm not killing people. And we put this hierarchy to them just like religious leaders of Jesus' day. And I think sometimes we ask ourselves the same question, which is the most important commandment? Which is the most important one? Because I'll focus on that, and I don't have to pay so much attention to the others, because I'll get the main thing right. Well, that certainly is what they were trying to catch Jesus with. So how does Jesus reply? Verse 37, Jesus replied, You must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. Jesus quotes word for word the most memorized and recited passage in all of Judaism. Everyone who would have heard these words from Jesus would have had this passage memorized. It comes out of Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 through 5. Jesus selected a command that politically you could not speak against. Jesus picks a command that everybody that was listening would had to have agreed with, even in their hearts, if they would have argued it. I mean, imagine this. Jesus is basically saying, the most important commandment is to love God. Anyone want to disagree with that? That anything other than loving God is more important? I mean, privately, they would have argued all of this, but Jesus picks the one command that would have been political suicide for any of these religious leaders to speak against. And it reminds me of a leadership council meeting that I was in about 8 years ago. The elders here at Hillcrest get together once a month, pray for the church, talk about our direction, make a lot of decisions, in partnership with a lot of other people here at Hillcrest. And we were in this meeting, and we had one of our departments, our student ministry department, that was short on cash, coming near the budget year and into the budget year, and we were tight on money as a church. We're not always tight on money, but we were really tight on money. And they were wanting to purchase some Bibles for some of the students in the student ministry program. And so they were asking for an over and above expense. Well, anytime you spend your budget amount and you want to spend more than your budget, that's going to create some discussion. And so sure enough, it was being discussed. And every option was being talked about. Everything was being discussed. And I tell you, the conversation was going on and on and on. And one of our elders, I will leave that person nameless, said, it's time to vote. Who says we should buy Bibles for children, and who says children shouldn't get Bibles? Which really reframed the question. It was unanimous, by the way. We bought Bibles for the children. But it's much like what Jesus is doing here. You know, what's the greatest commandment? They think they're going to catch him. And he says to love God. Anyone want to argue that? No one can argue it. So he kind of catches them in their own thing, kind of revealing the conditions of their heart in this catch. But he says to love with your heart, your soul, and your mind, which is, of course, what Deuteronomy says. Love in the Jewish community was not an emotion. In our culture today, it is mainly an emotion that we talk about when we say love. Or an infatuation, or a desire for. I want you to know that when you come across the word love in scriptures, there is some instances where there is some emotion attached to it, but it's mild. When you come across love in the Bible, it is always a verb. It is an action word, not an emotional response, not a feeling. Love was demonstrated through action. So if you were going to love God, it was going to be through evidence of action. And when you loved, you did it with all of who you are, which is what Jesus is saying here. Love with your heart and your soul and your mind. Everything that is you, you love God with. But again, it's an action word and not just an emotional act. But Jesus isn't done. There is more to his thought of what this greatest commandment might be. And there were people there that would have identified that they loved God. They would have said, oh yeah, I love God. And again, it's not an emotional response. They would have said, I love God because I keep the law and I make sure others keep it. That's my service to God. Or I love God because I keep the judicial system of God's law and I prosecute all people who don't keep God's law. I serve God that way. I love him through my actions. So, though they would have agreed with this, Jesus adds a tagline onto what love is so that there's a definition to use when it comes to love. And that's what we see in verse 39. He says, a second is equally important. Love your neighbor as yourself. The entire law and all the demands of the prophets are based on these two commandments. A second is equally important. The word equal means that they are on the same playing field and one is not more important than the other. It's second because he has two things, and he says one, and out of the one flows the second one. But they're not on this level. They're on the same playing field. They are equal. So in other words, you might look at this and say, Jesus is giving two commands, but the way Jesus words this, he's still giving just one. To love God, and out of your love for God comes a love for people. In other words, if you say you love God, the evidence of that love is your love for people. Let me say it another way. If you don't love people, you do not love God. You let that sink in for a second? This is repeated again and again through the scriptures. It's not the loving of people that helps us love God, but it's our love for God and our understanding of who he is and his call in our life and our desire to follow him, and our heart starts beating with his and our eyes start to see the world like he sees it, that what flows out of that is a natural love for other people. They're not two separate issues. They're one and the same. God is love, and God loves his people. And if we're followers of Christ, we are to love God, and in our love for God, we love people. And if we're a people that fail in loving others, we do not love God. We might say it, we might want to believe it, but we do not. And that's a challenge. That's a challenge for me. As I think of, you know, this horizontal relationship with God has to be lived out vertical relationship with God has to be lived out horizontally with others. It's one and the same. You can't have one without the other. A true love for God has to flow out in love for others. If it's not, there's something wrong with the love for God. If you're just working on loving others, that's not going to get you to love God, because it is the second. It's the byproduct. It's the result of loving God. You will love others. There are a lot of people today that are just working on loving others, and they don't like it. It still leaves them empty. They go and they serve, and they go, I'm just too busy for this. I'm sick and tired of trying to go help here, and someone needs help to move here. And they almost begrudge it. And they try not to say it. It's because it's not based out of a love for God. It's out of a desire to, if I do this, maybe somehow God will love me. And you can't earn God's love. It's about your walk with God, your love for God, and when you get that right, you'll start to love others, because love is action, and you'll see it lived out. How are you doing at loving God? Is there evidence for that love? I'm going to show you a short video that kind of summarizes what we just talked about.
Check this out. 1,977 years, 134 days, 16 hours, and 28 minutes ago, Jesus was asked, what is the greatest commandment? Jesus simply answered, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. The message says, love the Lord your God with all your passion, prayer, and intelligence. You see, our love for God must be sincere, not just by the words we speak, but also by engaging our souls. To truly love God, we must be passionate about him, inside and out. The only way to follow this command is to make loving God our first priority. That means everything else takes a back seat. But there's more. Jesus also said, the second greatest commandment is to love your neighbor as yourself, which also means love others as well as you love yourself. Love the unlovable, love the ones who don't deserve it, and love like you want to be loved. So the lesson is simply this: love God, love others. But the great thing is, if we make loving God our first priority, then loving others comes naturally.
Should come naturally. Every one of us are called to love God, and in doing so, to love other people. So many people will say that they love God, and I think truly believe it in their hearts that, yes, I love God, but not understand what the definition of loving God is, because they may still harbor prejudice or bitterness or resentment in their hearts. If that's the case, it reveals they have a long way to go before truly loving God. Loving God is not a decision that you make, but it's an action that's lived out in the second commandment of loving others. If you love God, you will love others. Okay, when this concept was made clear to me, it revealed for maybe the first time in my life why my relationship with God wasn't where it needed to be. Because I kept trying to do all the things that I was told would give me a good relationship with God. And that was, I went to church and I tried to read my Bible. It was super boring, but I did the best I could. I tried to pray. I tried to pray at times other than when it was the "Oh God" prayers. I tried to help out. I tried to get involved in stuff with church, but it always seemed like something wasn't catching and something wasn't working. And when I understood that my love for God is played out in my love for others, I had to really own up to where I was in my heart towards other people. And there were people that I wasn't forgiving that I should have forgave. But I kind of gave myself a pass on those because what they did was really bad. And if I told you some of the things that they did, you would also say to me, "Oh yeah, Doug, you don't have to forgive them." I mean, maybe you're more spiritual than I, so of course you would say I should forgive them. But you'd at least understand why I wasn't. The world certainly wouldn't allow or force me to forgive them. I mean, I didn't have any tragedies like this, but I mean, if someone murders your family member of yours, no one's going to say you need to forgive them. But I started to learn that the tragedies in my life and the difficulties and the people that had wronged me, at least that I felt had wronged, I realized that my relationship with God was being affected because I wasn't effectively loving others as a result. And I had to take the things that I knew and the things that God was calling me to do because of my closeness with Him, and I had to live that out in my relationship to others. And when I started to do that, things started to heal in my relationship with God as well. But it didn't end there. Because then I started to look around the world around me and started to say, "Okay, God, give me your eyes. I want to see my neighborhood and my community and my workplace," before I worked at a place like this, but I want to see Him with your eyes. I want my heart to beat for the things that your heart beats for. And when I started to look that way, all of a sudden opportunities came to serve and to love others that were not based off of just my effort to go do something because God would be happy, but started to flow out of my walk with God. And I started to see needs. A few years ago at Hillcrest, we really started to focus on this, realizing that if we were going to be a church that says that we love God, we better love our community. And if we were honest with ourselves, the community didn't even know that we existed. You went to any of our neighbors, you went to any of the businesses around here, they didn't even know who we were. I mean, they might have known us by name, but they didn't know us. And we said, it's time that this changes. If we're going to claim we love God, we better start looking at this community with God's eyes and start loving this community, because this horizontal relationship is deeply tied with our vertical relationship with God. And that's some of what you see on the wall. I mean, we just asked you and said, what are you passionate for? What do you see God up to? What is God telling you? And these are the things that Hillcrest came up with. It wasn't like it was some list of things that we thought were super wonderful, just stuff that came out of all that. These are ways that you can plug in as well. Like the Powerhouse Tutoring Center. We have a home over by Wesley United Methodist Church. We've partnered with them, and we help kids in that community. And these kids really need the help. And we have 7 weekly volunteers that are there after school. And we need more volunteers. You can serve one day a week. You can do once a month. Once a quarter. Jesse will take you. Jesse's the one that will play the keyboard here. Jesse Matson, she's our director. Talk to her, talk to us. We'd love to get you connected with the Powerhouse Tutoring Center. We started loving on Cleveland Elementary, and it's gone beyond Cleveland into the public school system because so many of our people live in such diverse areas. But school-based mentoring, and that's sitting down with a kid for 1 hour, not even an hour, it's over their lunch hour, which they don't get an hour. I used to get an hour, but they don't get an hour. And you just spend time with that kid. You're a listening ear, a caring adult. You'd be amazed. That could change your life. It could change that kid's life. Or a reading buddy, even less time. It takes about 15, 20 minutes. It's our desire for these children that are in real need, either because of a lack of attention at home or just maybe some of the language barriers. But they need a little extra attention to become literate and pass those proficiency exams. And so you sit down with a book, and you read to the child reads to you, and then you go home and you come back the next week. The teachers will take you any time during the day. And it's not just reading, but they need math buddies too. And it's elementary math, and you can do it. Okay? 2 + 2 = 5. And then Genesis Project. This is where we take people that are homeless, and we partner with them to help them secure their own safe and permanent housing. It's with community outreach. We partner you with a family and with others. It's not like you're all on your own. You get training in order to do it. It's a tough ministry. Our scorecard on this is 0. We have not had success with this, but we keep trying. But I think God would want us to keep trying, you know? So this is a tough ministry. This is where you put your heart and soul into something, and then it flops, okay? Awesome. That's a good sales pitch. Over here, last year we went to the Republic of South Sudan, and we're helping a little village named Kalalai there. We're trying to help them with agricultural projects. This year, in 2012, we want to go in around March and help with clean water. We want to get a well for them. And so we're looking for people that will join us with that. They need education. They need medical care. They need food security. And this is a village that is out in the sticks. In the most African of Africa you can think of. History Channel kind of stuff. And when we went there last year, we were the first white people they'd ever seen. And they have to walk by when March comes, they'll be walking between 5 and 10 miles every day to get clean water. Every day. I'm sorry, to get water. It is not clean. And we can put a well there. We have an orphan ministry, foster care and adoption. Jesus said to care for the orphans. And so we've come alongside families who feel God's call to adopt but have not been able to pull the funds together for it because it's been cost prohibitive. And we believe that God calls us as a church to love the orphans. And so we take the funds that we have here, and that's what it goes towards. And we've helped now 6 children that were in an orphan now live in a loving home. And so if that's you, let us know. We want to partner with you. Foster care. Maybe this commitment doesn't work for your life, but foster care would. This is where you prepare your family to be able to take an orphan who has been pulled out of the home for whatever reason. Maybe there's, drug abuse in the home or all kinds of terrible situations these kids face, and they need a place to go for a week or 2 weeks or a month or maybe 3 months. And there's a very short term and there's longer term. It's up to you. You get to choose whether it's a boy or a girl or what the age is. All of that you get to pick. And there are kids filled in orphanages here in Sioux Falls that are waiting for a home that would say, we'll take that child for the 2 weeks until, the court system gets things figured out or the relative is ready to take them or mom and dad are back on their feet in order to take them. Is your home big enough for a child for a period of time like that? Talk to us. We want to help you become foster care family. Or the backpack program. We're going to take a collection for this at the close of our service. But this is children who are on free and reduced meals at the schools. They have some of the kids are very neglected, and moms and dads are maybe too strung out to even care to feed the kids. They go home on the weekends and they don't eat, or what they do eat is terrible. The Feeding South Dakota, our food bank here in town, has put together these backpacks, and on Friday the kids get a backpack and there's enough food for them to eat for the entire weekend. They get back into school and they get the free and reduced meals, the lunch and the breakfast, but this helps them on the weekend. $145 gives a backpack to one student for the entire year, every single weekend. And we're asking that our families would sponsor one child. $145 from your family to help one child have food for the year. We're setting a goal for 75 backpacks. I don't know what the numbers were in the first service, what we collected, but we encourage you that this is a way to kind of put your faith into action. Maybe you have time and you can do some of these. Maybe you have resources and you do these. But this is what this vertical, horizontal relationship is about. And it doesn't have to be these things. You could do anything. These are just things that here at Hillcrest, we've said our heart beats for these things. And this is one way we want to love our community. And we're doing the best we can with it, and we can do a lot better, but we're trying. And our community thinks differently about Hillcrest today than they did 3 years ago. 3 years ago, they didn't know us. Today, there are certain organizations here that would suffer if we pulled out. Because we're here, and we're making a difference, and we're loving our community. Not because it gives us perks, but because we love God. And the final thing that I would throw your way this morning about these horizontal relationships is, you know, maybe you're like me and there's some people in your life that you need to resolve some things with. Some of the people that hurt me, I needed to forgive them. And as I thought about that, I realized there were some things that I needed to ask for forgiveness for. There may be people in your life that have hurt you that are no longer alive. Maybe there's a father that you've never reconciled with, or a mother, or some other relative. We want to give you an opportunity today at the close of our service to come up here and grab a pad and write a letter. And if you want that letter to be mailed out, we have envelopes and stamps. We'll mail it for you. If you just need to write the letter because you need to kind of purge it, maybe the person isn't even around, you could write the letter, put it in an envelope, don't address it, leave it here, we'll shred it for you. And just be a prayer letter that you write. Maybe you're like me and you like to write the letter, put it in an envelope, commit to sending it, and then sit on it for 3 months. It's generally my MO. But I set it there on the corner of my desk and I look at it every day and I remind myself that my relationship with God suffers when I don't get right my relationship with others. So at the close of the service, you can come and write a letter at your own private time. If you want to sign up for one of these things here, you can go to the back welcome counter and Pastor Brian would love to get you signed up for something. If you want to give to the backpack program, we're going to bring those wooden towers up here to the front. At the close of the service, you can come up and you give to the backpack program. No pressure. But if you're looking for opportunities to love others, these are some things that Hillcrest is a part of doing. Let's pray. Father God, we thank you for your love for us. And though I feel like I say that every single Sunday, I'm not sure we put the right emphasis on thankful. Because your love was so complete. You loved us with a love that was sacrificial, that you gave your life for us. And you have asked us to love people with that same sacrificialness. Father God, may our love for you be played out in our love for others. May our lives be an illustration of our love for you. May we not just give it lip service. For God, our love for you can't just be about coming to church. It has to be about the way that we live. Lord, may we be reminded of the great commandment to love God, and as a result, to love others. Help us, inspire us, challenge us, convict us, and continue to love us as we do our best to show you our love for you. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, next week we're going to finish up this series as we talk about the aspect of being a Christian that has to do with what we share with one another. We'll talk about that next week. God bless you as you come, as you go from here. You're dismissed.